Did you know I have two different kinds of classes? One you can do self-paced through Thinkific, and another one you can do directly with me on www.patreon.com/Mr. Chess. And you can also invite me out to your school, and I can support you there, do trainings, whatever you need to be supported. I'm here to help.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chess's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching podcast, where I introduce you to the people that can help you on your leadership, parenting, and teaching journey. And today we are continuing our Supporting Children with Disabilities conference, and I'm going to share some things that we talked about today. I think I really want to focus on joint attention and executive functioning skills. Also, continually focusing on connection and visuals, because there's so much more I could say about it. There's so much more I could say to support you and supporting your children, but it is more difficult to explain visuals without a visual, but I will do my best. And I'll put some resources in the show notes so that you can see some of what I'm talking about, or maybe print off some of these resources for yourself, because maybe you have a child who is autistic or ADHD, or maybe just needs a little bit more support getting from point A to B, or with emotional regulation or any executive skills. This might be helpful for anyone. You know, the interventions and the things that we use for our neurodivergent population are also things that are helpful for our neurotypical kids as well. But, you know, it's kind of like the squeaky wheel gets the grease kind of thing. So we tend to use more of these strategies when it comes to children who are neurodivergent. But these strategies are helpful for everyone. And honestly, things like visuals, they're helpful for us adults too. I mean, think about, you know, I gave the example of the store. But also think about the going to the airport. Think about driving on the road. Think about, you know, at work, like all the visuals that are around us to help guide us, they're helpful for not just children, but also adults. Let's talk about connection and why children have a tend to resist connection. And a lot of times we call these kids connection resistant, relationship resistant, that they are resisting relationships, that they don't like relationships, that they don't engage in relationships with other people. And that is a stigma that is not true. And I love the reframe that Elizabeth says of, instead of thinking of these kids as relationship resistant, really thinking about the truth of the matter. They're relationship selective, right? They tend to be more selective who they decide to be in relationship with. So let's talk about four common causes why children tend to be relationship selective. One is they're trying to protect against being hurt again, or being hurt even more, or being hurt more than they've already have in the past, or just afraid of being hurt. And, you know, there are many adults out there who've gotten out of, you know, very difficult relationships or divorces who probably can really relate to this. It makes a lot of sense why children who've been hurt in the past would be slow to build relationships again with someone else in the future. Another reason could be they don't feel safe. And when we think about like not feeling safe, sometimes we think about like, oh, like someone might physically harm me. But also we don't think enough about things like not feeling safe because sensory experiences, right? Maybe it's the tag in their shirt. Maybe it's the way that their pants fit. Maybe it's the sound that is coming out them. They're processing too much auditory input, or at least trying to. The lights can be maybe too bright or even loud. Sometimes the lights can be loud. Those fluorescent lights that just buzz all day can be very dysregulating for children. Another reason is there could be something that you're doing that reminds them of something that triggered them in the past, of something that, a way that they've been hurt in the past. And I'll give you a couple examples of this. There's actually someone at my table today. We were having a conversation and I was talking to a woman who supports in the classroom. She's someone who comes in to support. And so she does a lot of one-on-one with children. and she sometimes documents what's happening all through her phone. There's an app she uses her phone to document, you know, the new age technology. We have access to this now, and it makes things easier. All the paperwork that teachers have to do, you know, to make it easier to document and to send off and pay attention and be present with the child, can be a very difficult task. So she takes her phone out to document what's going on, and she noticed that tends to trigger this child. And what this child says when she pulls out her phone just to document what's going on, she could be saying like, oh, like we're having a wonderful time. He's learning. He's growing. But when he sees that phone, it reminds him of something that likely happened in the past. Because the thing that he says is, don't text my mom. Don't text my mom. Right? And they could be having a great time. There's no animosity. Everything's going well. And then when she pulls out their phone to document it, he says, don't text my mom, and it triggers him, and it breaks the connection, and it makes it difficult for the teacher to continue supporting this child. And that's an example of it reminding this child of a past hurt. And that is one reason why a child might be resistant to connection. And there's really two ways that I offer that you could approach this, and whatever works for you, whatever you think is more valuable, you know, you can choose to do. You know, one thing you could choose to do is you could choose to find a different way to document this information, right? Clearly, the phone is the thing that is triggering him. If you remove the trigger, then he probably won't be triggered by you documenting, writing it down on a piece of paper. Because he does not have that story in his mind about, oh, when an adult takes out their phone, when I'm with them, they're going to be sending a text to my mom. And, you know, you really have to think, like, this is no fault of the teacher, right? This is an expert. They're allowed to use their phone to document. It was just a previous teacher that probably was so frustrated and so dysregulated and didn't know, have these conscious discipline skills, didn't know what to do. So they used the skills that they had in the tool belt, right? They were in their emotional state. They saw it as me versus you. They're probably trying to overpower this child. And this was a triggering experience for this child, clearly. So yes, one, you could choose to just do away with the phone, but also, you know, and that's why this nuance is important, and there's it's not a black and white answer, because that could be the only effective way to actually document. And so what else could we do if we were going to keep the phone, if we decided we absolutely need this phone or this trigger absolutely needs to be here? What else could you do? So I offered something which would take more skill than just taking the phone away, but again, it's your choice. Whatever you think is more, will work best for you, is what you can choose to do. And what I offered was to use the language of safety, to let him know what you're going to do. And there's kind of two ways you can do it. You could say, oh, I'm going to text your mom about the, or I'm going to document. Don't say I'm going to text your mom. Don't say that. Say, I'm going to document, or I'm going to write down, I'm going to type down whatever words the child understands, how you finished your puzzle with success, or how you got frustrated, took a deep breath, and you figured out how to solve the problem. You did it, right? You could say it like that, or you could kind of flip it and go straight to the encouragement and say, wow, you took a deep breath and found a different way to solve the puzzle. That took determination. I'm going to tell your mom about it so we can celebrate. You did it. High five. Right? And so that way they know what you're doing, and it takes this mystery out of it. And that may be a different way that you can do it and still keep the phone out to document. And just in general, ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, can create relationship selectiveness in children. Because of what happened to them, they'll have a harder time trusting the world and trusting the adults around them. I did an episode with DJ Inspires Parenting, and we talked about ACEs. It's called Surviving 10, and it's a previous podcast episode. So how can we reframe this for us so that we can show up more helpful in these situations, so that we can connect with these children, so that we can support these children? Now, the reframe that I would suggest that you use, a lot of times you say, these children are being difficult. This child is so difficult. I have these difficult children. And now, are they being difficult, or was it life difficult for them, right? Are they being difficult, or was it difficult for them, right? They're experiencing difficulty themselves. And not just now in the current, in the present, but there's a chance that they might have experienced a lot of difficulty in the past. If you can't talk or see or hear or engage and connect like your peers, that's difficult. That's going to create difficulties. That is going to create struggle. So what do we do about this? I really suggest learning about I Love You rituals. I'm a big fan of I Love You rituals, and I've seen it be impactful for neurotypical and neurodivergent children. Now, neurodivergent children may not come to you immediately with it, and if you're in a classroom, you might start I Love You rituals with someone who you know is willing, who will catch on quickly, so that they can be a model for their peers, and that will spark curiosity in them, and they'll likely come over and do it. I actually had a neurodivergent child who was autistic in my class, and we did I Love You rituals, and he loved them. Now, he didn't love them at first, and he wasn't the first one to come to do an I Love You ritual, but I'll tell you, once we built that relationship, he was one of the first ones who came up to do the I Love You rituals. And during hard times, he would come and ask for it. And it really helped him through a lot of his day. And it became routine. I made it predictable. Every time, you know, I would, it was every time after snack time, or every time after like circle time, or during, like, I would be consistent with when I was doing the I Love You ritual. So they were to add predictability. And we talked about that yesterday in the last podcast episode, that predictability is so important for helping children feel safe. And so I Love You rituals and making it predictable. And I Love You rituals are these, they can be, I like to actually call them connection rituals, because at the root, that's what they really are. They are rituals that have the four components of connection. They're little hand games, and they take old nursery rhymes. Typically, they don't have to be this way, but the I Love You rituals book is this way. They took old nursery rhymes, adapted them for healthier messaging, and added like hand games and little connection, the four components of connection, which if you remember are what? Let's see, I'm going to give you a second to see if you can tell me the four components of connection. And if you're with someone, let's see if we get it right. I'm gonna give you 7 seconds. Let's see if you can, what are the four components of connection? Okay, yep, that's one. Okay, so eye contact, touch, a playful situation, and presence are the four components of connection. And so those I Love You rituals, those connection rituals, have those built into them. So if you get the I Love You rituals book, you can learn some of these. And some of the most popular ones is Run Around the Garden, especially for young children. I'll sing it for you right now. You put your finger on the child's palm and you make a circle and you say, round and round the garden goes the teddy bear. Then you walk up their arm, one step, two step, tickle on your hair. I say tickle on your hair, but tickle under there, tickle over there, whatever, however you want to do it. But that is one that is super popular with, I know the toddlers twos that I work with absolutely loved it. And even the autistic children love the I Love You rituals. And even, you know, so some of the people you're listening to, well, my child is autistic and eye contact is uncomfortable. And again, this is this relationship selective kind of thing. the autistic child that I was talking about working with very much did not want to do, when I met him, was not making eye contact with me, did not want eye contact. But I Love You rituals, we would make moments of eye contact, and that's something to celebrate. Now, it was never forced. He was always willing. It doesn't, you know, eye contact is even helpful for all children who are autistic as well. Now, forcing eye contact is not helpful. And that is where we kind of, that's where the rub is. And that's where I think a lot of the misinterpretation about eye contact and autism is. They have to be willing participants in the eye contact, right? And so how do you do that? How do you get this, the inspire this eye contact in children who are, may typically be resistant to it? And the answer is you spark their curiosity. You spark their curiosity, right? And so some of the noticing language of like, oh, your arm is going like this, you know, or you have like, oh, do you see this? And you're looking, maybe it's a, you have sunglasses in your hand, right? You have an object that they're looking at the object, but you put them in front of your face. So they're, you know, they're looking at the object, but you're also getting a little bit of that eye contact, because the eye contact, the all that connection is helpful. It that creates those connections. So here, so this is what it is. Connections on the outside of the brain, which is our connections, the way we connect with children, create connections on the inside of the brain, right? Which prime the brain for willingness and learning. So this connection can be helpful. But again, I can't emphasize enough, avoid forcing it. Right? Avoid forcing it. Spark their curiosity, get their willingness for the eye contact, touch, playful situation, press, and all the other, like, don't forcefully touch them, but they don't want to be touched, right? It goes for all components connection. Create the willingness. Now, what I love about I Love You rituals, especially for those who have big families or anyone who's in a classroom, is that once you teach the I Love You rituals and you do it with the children, and they're used to it and they know it and they've practiced it and you've done it over and over and over again, they'll start doing it with each other, right? You can encourage them to do it with each other, and then they're getting that connection with each other. They're getting that willingness. They're priming their brain for learning. They're priming their brain for growth. And it's not even you doing it. You created something that will take its life of its own, that they will help regulate each other through these I Love You rituals. Now let's talk about conflict for a moment. And I actually had this quote, I put it on Threads, I think I just put it on Instagram. And what I said was that if there's no conflict in the relationship, then someone doesn't feel safe and connected enough to engage with it. If there's no conflict in the relationship, someone in the relationship does not feel safe and connected enough to engage in it, right? I mean, think about like all the times where, you know, maybe you thought about like your boss and maybe saying something about like bringing up a grievance you have or bringing up something that you feel like is important that they could do to help you. And then, you know, you go, you think about it and you're like, ah, it's not even worth it. I'm not even going to say anything. Like nothing's going to happen. Like they're just going to yell at me, or they're just going to look at me in a negative way. They're just going to judge me. Like it's not even worth it. Like I'm not even going to go there. Like I'll just don't go ahead and deal with it. That's an example, right? Of you not feeling safe and connected enough to engage in conflict, right? And I mean, anyone who's, you know, been in a relationship for a long time, I'm sure you've had some conflict, right? And maybe the strangers you met, or maybe the people you work with, or you're not very close with, or you're doing a lot of corporate speak, you're constantly avoiding conflict because you don't, there's no safety, there's no connection in it. So we'll dress up this language, and you know, we will do all these things to try to avoid conflict. And it's because the environment hasn't, we don't feel safe and connected enough. Right. And that's part of what people, you know, like people make these videos and make fun of it. And, you know, there's a sense of like, oh, this disdain for it. And I think that is what's underneath the disdain for the corporate talk, the lack of authenticity, the lack of safety and connection that it shows is in the environment, because you have to do this corporate talk instead of clear communication that gets to the point in a respectful and authentic way. So we have these avoidance patterns, right? We avoid conflict, right? And which will sometimes we will avoid relationships altogether. But I'm not ready for a relationship. I don't want to do the conflict. I just got out of a relationship. Like, I'm just going to avoid it altogether, right? Who's been there? Or at least know someone who's been there. Sometimes we have this mental model that when the relationship ruptures, that it's not okay to repair, or repairing admits that you are making a mistake, which will make you, you know, feel unworthy, you're unloved. And if I made a mistake, if I own up to what I did, then you may not love me anymore, right? But maybe if I pretend that I did make a mistake, that you'll still love me. Although we all know what happens, and that often puts more of a strain on the relationship. Instead of just accepting that rupture and repair isn't a part of a relationship, and sometimes we avoid the repair for that reason, right? The vulnerability is too dangerous for us. Forgiveness is hard. It's scary. And it requires us to take ownership of what we did. And we are not very good at that, because our parents were not very good at that. But, you know, they would spank us in a forced isolation, you know, shame us, call us names, whatever it was, when they didn't have the skills to navigate the situation. So they just resorted to their emotional state and survival state skills. You know, a lot of our parents repaired, or they try to repair the relationship like this. They would, you know, maybe they would, you know, there was a rupture in the relationship, you separated, they forced you in isolation, you're up there, right? And maybe they come and they knock on your door. Knock your room, they open the door and they say, "Dinner's ready." And that was the apology. "I'm sorry for yelling at you for running around in the house." It makes sense that you had a lot of energy after school because you were at school all day and you were sitting all day. Now, it sounds like you need more time to move your body and exercise and play before we come home, or maybe before we walk in the door. Next time, let's play in the yard, in the backyard or the front yard when we get home, so that you can use some of your energy. Or if it's raining, maybe we can have a dance party. Can we try that for tomorrow? Are you willing to try this with me? You know, and they said, "Yes, all right." And then you work on it and you try and you practice the next day. You know, and you might also offer this child to, you know, practice a skill to recognize when he does have a lot of energy and when he does want to run around. And so maybe what it is saying, "Next time, let's practice you telling me that you have a lot of energy, that you need to run around instead of just running around. Let's practice this. Okay, so let's pretend you're in your body and you feel like you want to move." And you can probably even hear me moving right now, right? Modeling it, right? And let them actually see and then kind of get into it. It's like, "Okay, you want to move. What do you do?" And you show them first. You always want to model and say, "Oh, I have a lot of energy. Can we have a dance party? Can you put on some music? Can you put on Shake It Off by Taylor Swift?" You know, whatever it is. And then, you know, you practice that. You have them do it. You have them go through the actual motions. And that might be a way to solve the problem. It might not be. But the point is, you are taking accountability for your actions. You're owning up to your actions. And you're making a plan to do better next time. How great would life be if children had at least that skill perfectly, right? If children could take ownership of, you know, what they did, and they could, you know, come up, they could problem solve with what to do next time and make commitment and problem. They had that skill, they would learn on their own. But we can learn that skill and model that skill, and eventually they will start to use that skill, and that will exponentially help their growth. Because when they make a mistake, they're not beating themselves up, and they're more open to the learning of the situation. And you know, we have a hard time doing that as an adult, right? We don't learn from our situations where we end up yelling, we got triggered, and we ended up yelling or spanking or whatever we're doing that was not aligned with our values. And then we say, "Well, this is your fault. You need to listen the first time. Well, I wouldn't have done this if you would have just listened to me, right? If you just would have did what I said, that this wouldn't have happened." It's completely taking responsibility away from ourselves. Meanwhile, we'll tell them all day, like, "You're responsible for your own decisions. If they jumped off a bridge, would you do it too?" Right? Like, we'll say that, but we don't do it ourselves. So we really do need to model that ourselves, and that will be a springboard for our own growth. And then we can recognize these moments where we get triggered and we do things outside of our values as true gifts for our learning journey. It's going to be really hard to see that in the moment and really see it as a gift. I get it. But once you get to that executive state, that place of reflection, you might be able to see it. And that's the place where you're going to be able to learn and grow from what happened. In that silence, right? Maybe much later than what this situation happened. But that's where you come back. And you do the repair, and you learn, and you grow, and you really honestly try it next time. And without that trigger, without that moment of dysregulation, and this is why I'm saying it's a gift, you would have never figured out what your trigger was. Right? You would have never figured out how to maybe work through that trigger. You would have never figured out how to help that child. You went on a journey to learn new skills to teach your child that ultimately is really about helping you learn and grow and teaching you. So these are actually gifts. You know, without children, would you really be on this journey? Maybe not. And you might be, you know, coasting through life. But as you learn these skills, they enhance all parts of your life. And there's one teacher that said something at the last conference that I was at that I just think is such a great way to put it. And I think it's the most accurate thing I've ever heard from to describe why conscious discipline is helpful and why you should do it. And it comes from Kim Hughes was doing a training. This is not my story. This is Kim Hughes' story. She was doing a training and she... I was doing a training for a teacher who was about to retire. He's like, I don't need this stuff. Like, I'm about to retire. Like, I don't need it. Like, cool, y'all do whatever, but I'm about to retire. I don't really need it. So Kimmy's like, cool, whatever. Sees her down the line later, not later that day, but much later, maybe like years later. And she's like, hey, do you remember me? And she's like, oh yeah, I think I do. You're going to retire. Like, what's going on with that? And she said, well, I was going to retire, but after, you know, going to your training, I wanted to try some of the things. And just try it out in the classroom. So I stayed. And, you know, I thought it was going to be one more thing added to my plate. But the funny thing was, is that conscious discipline was like the seasoning. That once I had conscious discipline, everything on my plate tasted better. And I think that's such an accurate representation of what conscious discipline does, is that it helps you navigate all of those situations, all of those difficult moments that you and your children and your family struggle with. Conscious discipline makes it easier because you know how to navigate rather than just trying to tread water, but you don't know how to swim. You're just trying, just flailing, right? You're just flailing. You're drowning, but you're flailing. And so you're using a bunch of energy and you're tiring yourself out because you're just kicking yourself and all that energy is keeping you up a little bit because and you're getting some things right with how you're crazy, you're moving your body, but you waste a lot of energy. And as opposed to learning how to swim and learning how to tread water and learning what those actual emotions are for you to use all of your energy more intentionally. And then it's much easier to float. Then you can float for much longer and you can swim and you can get, and you won't, and you're not drowning. You don't feel like you're drowning. You feel safer and you feel better about what you're doing and navigating the conflict. Let me share some connection milestones that might be helpful for you. And remember, I'm always hesitant to share milestones because it can be triggering for a lot of people. But, you know, these are just kind of averages. They're not exact. So don't stress about it too much. But if you're recognizing that they're not meeting these milestones and, you know, you're working on it and you're practicing it and you notice that they're not meeting these milestones, then that might be a signal, an indication that you might need some support. Maybe a SLP, a speech language pathologist, or an occupational therapist might be helpful for you. So we're going to go from really young. By 2 months, that kind of connection milestone would be the child's starting to smile at you, starting to do smiles. By 6 months, the child is starting to laugh with you. You're laughing and they're kind of reciprocating and they're laughing too. Those mirror neurons are kicking in and we're laughing together. By 12 months, we're starting to play games like peekaboo, right? Kind of these joint attention games. And this is kind of comes online. This is something that we would generally expect by 12 months. They can kind of start to do the peekaboo. And by 18 months, they will point to something to show their interest. And this is, you know, you'll see them kind of pointing at like their cup, or they're pointing at like maybe the fire truck that's in the window or that's coming, that routinely comes and predictably comes. So they look forward to it and they're excited. So they point at the fire truck or the garbage truck. Now, you might have been asking yourself, what is joint attention? And this is something that is important for you to know, because this is something that we use to start to assess if a child might be autistic. And really what a joint attention is, can we both pay attention to the same thing at the same time, right? Are we both looking at something or is both of our attention, joint attention, can we both focus on, maybe it's a game, maybe it's an object, maybe can we have this object that we're both focusing on at the same time? Now, joint attention really starts developing between ages 9 to 12 months. It's essential for the development of language and social skills. And this is something you can very easily practice. This is something you can very easily kind of start to assess for yourself. Now, remember, you're not the specialist, but you are the expert of your child. You may not be the expert of autism or ADHD or any diagnosis, but you are the expert of your child. So if you have this information, it will be really helpful for you to talk to the experts on those other things. So, I mean, it could be as simple as like you turning your head towards something that is like an interesting photo or an object. And are they able to turn their head and look at it and have a bit of attention, even if it's for a small period of time? Do they look at it too? You know, we'll often like point and look at the thing and turn our head and look at the thing, and they'll turn their head and they'll look at the thing, and then they'll look back at us, right? Because we're joining in that attention. So let's talk more about how to develop joint attention, right? So even when they make eye contact, even for like the briefest moment, celebrate it, respond to it, be like, ah, right? Or look at you, or there you are, right? Make that eye contact back and respond to it, right? Get that, give them that oxytocin, dopamine, endorphins, which we call joy juice, which is what happens when you connect with someone. We get that joy juice. We call it, in consciousness, we call it joy juice, but it's really a combination of oxytocin, dopamine, endorphins, which happens when you do things like connection rituals and play things like peekaboo, which, surprise, surprise, is a connection ritual in itself. Look, you're already doing it. It's not so scary because you're already doing a little bit of it, right? And there's lots of other ways that you can do it. You can maybe if you have an object and you go up, 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 down, up, 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 down. And you could do things like, you know, looking in the mirror. You can do things where you're going really fast. You're going like, we're going really, really fast. And we're going really, really slow. The car goes really fast. And then really slow. You play fast and slow games can be things. And I also love to make my voice really, really deep and really, really high. It can be another way to kind of get that joint attention. I think another example, and a lot of this, I'm doing a lot of stuff with my body that you're not seeing. And so another example that was given was, and you can really do your own kind of body, you know, visuals. Remember, visuals are very helpful. So your gestures, your body is a visual, right? Your gestures matter too, but you can make up your own, right? And I just say just be consistent so you can create that predictability. They can be excited about it. So you could do something, and my hands are over my head. My hands on the side. I might say something like, eh, eh, eh. And then I might do a little circle with my hands and say, oh, 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 eh, 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 ah, ah, ah. And just some sounds. And just to help children, especially who are working on learning their sounds, learning to put words together. You saying those sounds can help them learn those sounds and start to mimic those sounds. Now, let's take a moment to talk about the safe place. Because a lot of times, you know, you've probably all heard or seen like Cozy's Corners or Conscious Discipline, we call them safe places, right? And the safe place actually develops. The first safe place is you, right? Is really the first safe place is the womb. The womb is the first safe place. And then they come out the womb. And then the second safe place, first of since birth, is your chest. Your chest becomes their first safe place. And you have to regulate to keep that place safe, right? You have to be regulated. And if you're not, they may be able to feel that energy too. So we practicing regulation even before birth can be very helpful and worthy, because once they come out, they're expecting you to be that safe place for them. Then they get a little bit bigger, right? And maybe they start to walk and stand and move up. And now the lap becomes the safe place. They're no longer on your chest. They're in your lap. And they love to be in your lap, right? And so we're co-regulating with them. We're doing co-regulation with them. And then it goes from the lap, and then it turns into a beanbag chair, right? And that's where the safe place is, or a couch, you know? And that is that safe place is developing. And that's where, you know, we have all these feeling buddies and the five steps of self-regulation, and we teach them to go through all that stuff and how to regulate, and we talk about all that so they have the skills to, you know, and what we have to do is we have to co-regulate with them over and over and over and over again till they get the skills to self-regulate as they get older. And then that's when they become their own safe place. The safe place is internal. So when they get frustrated and the world's not going the way they perceive a threat, they're able to take care of their emotions themselves, right? And a lot of us still struggle with that, right? We struggle to be our own safe place. And we can only be our own safe place if we learn how to self-regulate and we learn how to talk to ourselves kindly. I mean, think about it. Like, if your friend talk to you the same way you talk to yourself when you make a mistake, would you keep that friend around? Right? You make a mistake, and you know, I'm so dumb, such an idiot, right? You label. If every time you made a, what your friend said, would you keep that friend around? Right? So we're not being a safe place for ourselves. We're creating toxicity within us. We're reinforcing it within ourselves. And so it does take a lot of skills. It does take practice. But the good news is that once we start to learn and start to teach children from a young age, that they don't have to do as much unlearning as we are having to do. They also talked about augmentative communication tools, AAC, which is pretty much when using the pictures and buttons to communicate. And this is something not a lot of people in the room had used this. There's a lot of people working with children with disabilities, and there weren't a lot of people who use this device. And this is something that is, I know a lot of people are advocating for more accessibility to AAC devices. And when they're really young, I think it can be really hard to teach it. But we talked about and they shared, as they get older and as they're able to use this device, it can be such a helpful communication tool that reduces the frustration of daily living for people who don't speak. So if you do have a child or know a person who does not speak and they are having a hard time communicating, I would say look more into AAC devices. From my understanding, they can be hard to get access to, but if you can, it seems like something that is extremely helpful, especially as they get older and they're more able to use the device and they're more agile. But you got to start somewhere, right? And let's talk, actually shift gears a little bit and talk about play development, how it develops. Now, first, the play starts with some social play, right? The little peekaboo games that we talked about, it's social. It may be the adult, it may not be their peers, but the adult and the child, whoever the child feels safe with, they will often engage in this social play. They'll do this peekaboo with their safe adults. And remember, it only takes one safe adult to buffer the impact of trauma. So it starts off with the social play, the peekaboo, and then the solitary play, the playing by themselves, and the parallel play. They're playing around each other, but not necessarily with each other. And then the more kind of like dramatic play and kind of role play where they're taking turns and engaging in roles and there's more structure to the social play. I'm actually going to end this talking about executive functioning skills. And the executive functioning skills are attention, time management, organization, prioritization, working memory, impulse control, emotional regulation, flexibility, empathy, metacognition, goal persistence, goal achievement, and task initiation. Now, a lot of our children in general are lacking in a lot of these skills, and these are lifelong skills that you practice, you're going to practice for your entire life. But children and people specifically, the part of their brain kind of responsible for the skill, the prefrontal lobes, they're not fully developed till 25, 26, right? And we have more research suggesting that it's even, for some people, it's even later than that. So executive skills are something that we are always wanting to build. And to for children to meet all these expectations that us adults have of them, we need to help build their executive skills. Now, conscious discipline has something called the Executive Skills Lending Library Checklist. And this is such a helpful tool. I believe it's on the Conscious Discipline website, same website where you buy the products, where, again, you can get free shipping using the code MrChaz24, but it's only going to work once per billing address. I'm going to kind of break down the lending library list for those who aren't going there, can't find it, because honestly, I don't have the link right now, so I'm going to just tell it to you. And what it does is it breaks down each of these executive skills and gives you some things to do to help build these skills. So for attention, right, if your child struggles with paying attention, noticing them instead of judging them, right, and seeing their attention signals, having a visual depiction of time, making tasks fun and interesting, and in teens, identify personal, societal, or global relevance. So if you want to help teens pay attention, you got to make it relevant to them. You got to make it something that they care about. If your child struggles with time management, and I know a lot of them do, and there was an interesting, Elizabeth said that the time management doesn't really come online till fourth to sixth grade. So that is just something to keep in mind. A lot of times we expect 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds to manage their time very well, and we are disappointed often with that expectation. Sometimes the problem isn't the child. Sometimes the problem is our expectations. So with time management, having a predictable routine can be helpful. Discussing how long it takes to do things. Pictures, calendars, and schedules. That's why I have a visual schedule. Mr. Chaz's visual schedules in all of my bio link. Picture and routine books, role play, practicing transitions, creating patterns, having auditory signals to kind of help them recognize when it's time to do the next thing or when the next thing is coming. And for teens, having an agenda or a daily agenda or a calendar can be helpful for time management. Now, let's talk about organization. Playing matching games can be helpful. Adults modeling thinking out loud, right? So like, oh, I'm going to put this in the red bin where the rest of the red blocks go, right? Guiding and prompting children, visual reminders, and picture books. And for teens, make planning and reflection notes. Now for prioritization, so here are some things that can be helpful to kind of build this executive skill of prioritizing. Giving directions in steps, you know, us prioritizing. And this is called the Executive Functioning Lending Library because we're lending our prefrontal cortex to children so that they can develop, so they can build their own, right? And so this often requires us to have our own executive functioning skills. So this can be a challenge for us as well, right? You know, giving directions in steps, visuals with steps involved. First, then books, right? We talked about that in the last episode. First this, then this, right? Dealing with time. Give simple 1 or 2 step commands. You know, just simple, like, don't give too many. Sometimes we will do, like, okay, put away your food, or we'll say something like, get dressed and come down, but there's like maybe 10 steps in getting dressed. Or we'll say something like, put your socks on, then put your underwear on, then put your pants on, then put your shirt on, and then make your bed and come down. That's a lot of steps. So sometimes just chunking it and making it just one or two steps at a time can be very helpful. Role-playing is another thing that can be helpful. And for teens, breaking down projects into smaller parts, chunking it. Okay, now working memory. Right? And this is something that I struggle with too. Like, I need my calendar to remember where I'm going to be at from day to day. If I did not have my calendar, I would not make it to any appointment on time. You would not even hear me. They would fire me from everything I ever signed up for, because I would probably not remember what time it was, where it's at. I can't keep all that stuff in my head. And I am someone who has ADHD. Yes, I am much older than 25, but still, again, these are lifelong practices. And so here's some things that you can do to help children like me and just people in general, but children specifically who struggle with working memory. And you can kind of look at, think about all these different skills that I'm talking about and just name two or three. You prioritize two or three executive skills for a child that you, maybe your child or a child you know that struggled, or a child that you're working with, that you would like to kind of work on, that you think there are some areas of opportunities that you can work on. And also, what are three strengths? What are their more strengths that they have? So for working memory, making eye contact before giving instructions, playing memory games, minimizing distractions, visual reminders of what to do, like my calendar, have the child repeat back instructions, right? So like, what did I say? It's like, okay, you're going to put it in the bin and you're going to come back and give me a high five. Okay, now what are you going to do? I'm going to put it in the bin and then come back and give you a high five. A daily agenda, my calendar again, and teens referring to the daily agenda, practicing referring to the daily agenda. Oh, what am I doing today? Oh, let's go check your agenda. It can be an example. Let's actually move on to impulse control and emotional regulation. Teaching routines, and this is something that we, I mean, if you are out there, if you wish that your child could have a little bit more impulse control, let me know. These are some things that are going to be helpful. Pay attention. I wish I could make eye contact with you so you can remember what I'm about to say. But I will bring it down for you. Teach routines. Teach stress reduction strategies like breathing, like shaking it out. Teach scripts for problem solving. Regulate the environment. Start and stop games like red light, green light. When I say regulate the environment, it might be like lowering the lights a little bit or making it not so loud. Face-to-face games like the connection ritual, the I love you rituals I was talking about. Movement. And in the library, the lending library, it actually says compose your lap. So, because, like, you know, sometimes children will take laps. It will go running back and forth, right? And so maybe running back and forth can be something that helps with impulse control and emotional regulation. So maybe even during homework, right? That can be something that might be helpful. Let's take a compose your lap, right? And for teens, teaching the conscious discipline brain state model, actually understanding the brain state model, understanding their brain will help them with their own impulse control. It'll help them understand it. It'll help them work through it. And it'll help them learn from the times where they're not able to be successful. So let's go to another one, flexibility. Flexibility, here are some things that are helpful for flexibility, to increase flexibility. And you know, if you have a child who has a hard time transitioning, right, they're not very flexible, or maybe you have a routine how things are going, but if something is different in the day, they just fall apart, or something doesn't go as they expect, they fall apart. These are some things that would be helpful for those children. Giving visual cues before transitions, like that visual timer that I always, it's another thing that is linked in my Instagram, TikTok bio, all my social media bios. Breaking down tasks, again, chunking it. Giving choices, creating social stories, role-playing anxiety situations. Reducing the novelty, which means, well, typically, right, we would say we do want novel things for, you know, especially children with ADHD, they pay attention to things that are new and interesting and novel. but they're struggling with flexibility, this might be a situation where you do want to take some of that that the new and different out. Now, what you do, like, okay, well, how do I do both at the same time? If they really like, so you start off with making it not so novel. Like, it's going to be novel the first time anyways you do a routine, right? Because it's new, it's different. But do it for a while. Do it for some weeks, right? And get the routine down. Make it whatever you're doing, the transition, get it down to almost every step, almost time down to a science, and then maybe add some things that are novel into, maybe you have a transition song or whatever, you do the same transition song, and maybe at some point you add something a little different in the song, right? And for teens too, all these can still be helpful for teens. Empathy, right? Now, we all want children to be empathetic, right? And sometimes we have a hard time being empathetic ourselves. So for empathy, noticing the body, reflecting their feelings, seeing the message underneath those, the what they're saying, reflecting their desires, that DNA process that we've talked about in other podcast episodes that describe, name, acknowledge. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go to one of I don't think we've talked about in this conscious discipline conference, but definitely in another one, or get the book. It definitely goes into it. I'm not going to go into it now because I have some other executive skills to cover. Implementing games to identify facial expressions and feelings, right? What's the feeling charades kind of thing. Discuss feelings of characters in literature, right? As you're reading books or watching, you know, shows and movies. It's like, oh, how do you think Mr. Bear felt when he was left out of the game, right? Like that, the opportunities to do some perspective taking will allow them to build that strength of empathy. And this is also the same for teens. Now, metacognition. Metacognition is really just talking to yourself. And we need metacognition for us to self-regulate. You know, like, again, this is the part of the brain that helps us regulate, and how we talk to ourselves can either really trigger us or really help us regulate. And so what can we do to build the skill? Ask the child how he or she feels about their effort and their accomplishments, as opposed to saying, good job, you did so great. Saying, oh, how did it feel to get that answer right, to figure that out, to finish the puzzle. Ask children to reflect on their work, right? On their play. Have pictures of what clean finish, etc. looks like, right? Teach children questions. And one example is, like, you know, you want to clean your room, but like their idea of clean might be different than your idea of clean. So put that picture of, you know, get the room clean of whatever your expectations is, and maybe help them out with it, and maybe do some chunking with cleaning up stuff, and then put a picture up of what it looks like. I like honestly getting pictures of not just the whole room, of just different parts of the room. Cause sometimes like the whole room could be too much and too overwhelming, but just, again, chunking it, different parts of the room. So they go up to it, like it's their desk, a big picture of like what their desk is supposed to look like right over their desk. So they can look, okay, this, everything is in its place. And teaching children to ask questions themselves, like, do I have enough space? Will this help me pay attention better? And so asking, so make sure that maybe they're coming to sit and saying, you know, make sure you have enough space. Do you have, asking them, do you have enough space? Well, then in their brain, they'll be like, do I have enough space? And then they'll be able to kind of, that's them talking to themselves. And for teens, provide, you know, class time for reflections, but journaling can all be very helpful for that. Now, goal persistence and goal achievement, making commitments, making class commitments, and those are part of our Brain Smart Starts. Encouraging steps toward a goal, provide positive feedback, start with small goals and then move to bigger goals, make visual charts to show progress, celebrate the goals, and for teens, it's the same thing. Now, the last one is task initiation. You can help a child choose options. You can verbalize the beginning of a project to build awareness. It might sound like, oh, look, we're starting to clean. You could also prompt the child if needed or offer choices. Use phrases like, you did it, good for you, look at you. And the one that I use, you did that. And for a teen, you can give them a little bit more responsibility. You can give them, let their prefrontal lobes do a little bit more work, and you can say something, you can ask, you can say, what might be your first step? Or how do you plan to get started? Now, I hope all of this has been helpful for you. It's been a great two-day conference. Little side note, when I come to these conferences, I give you the information, but then I share a little bit about my experience. This is my second time being a helper, and it was great. I loved it, and I learned a lot from the table. I was actually working with three tables, but mainly with one, the one I was sitting at. And I learned a lot. I'm not going to put all their business out there, but I'll say that I definitely am feeling pride in myself, recognizing my own accomplishment of really tapping into one of the leaders in the group, because the table I was sitting at had everyone came together. So everyone's at the same school. They already know their problems. And so often when, you know, we would turn and talk and have conversation there, because they already have common language, they already know their school. They're talking about certain kids and certain situations that I am not privy to because I'm not at their school. And so I'm having to do a lot of learning and understanding, and makes it a little bit more challenging to guide them in a way that is helpful in the short period of time that we really had. However, I found a leader in the group who at first was pretty quiet, and I kind of identified that she was a leader, and in kind of in the midst of everything, she put on her leadership hat and really tapped into something that I had not seen yet from her. And this actually happened yesterday, and it really shifted the energy of the table. And she, you know, I'm patting myself on the back because, you know, we had lunch today. Like, I was like, hey, actually, let's talk, and we connected. But I'm gonna pat myself on the back a little bit for it, because I was able to tap into that with her, and she was able to tap into her team more than what I would have been able to do. And it made all the difference, and it has inspired me even more to just really also look for those leaders and look for really support those leaders, and has really just made my helper experience filled with more learning than what I could have imagined. And when this leader really tapped into herself, this talent that she has, that she's in, and she mentioned that she was kind of in a mode to just receive and not give. But in conscious discipline, we have a phrase that says, what you give to others, you strengthen within yourself. And in that moment when I kind of was like, are you the leader in this group? And I kind of identified her as a leader. And then she kind of put that hat on. She shifted the energy at that table for the rest of the day. And even today, it felt different, and it created even more positive conversations, right? We talk about assertiveness and, like, you know, what you focus on, you get more of. And instead of just being problem focused and just talking, you know, this problem, we could identify the problems and then shift to what solutions to take. And we became much more solution minded. And honestly, the ideas that they came up with, that they were taught, and the same people who had a hard time focusing on solutions and were focused, they were now coming up with their ideas that were inspiring me and making me think and adding to my own growth. And that is the power of learning in a community. So, and that's also why I have created the learning community of my class. The class that I do once a month, that where we go deep into this stuff and really acknowledge the things that you guys are struggling with, and help you learn all the skills you need to be successful in guiding your children in a healthy and effective way. So this is my experience. I am now leaving this state of Texas. And yes, everything is bigger in Texas. I'm going to go back to my hometown and hopefully I get to not try. I've been traveling a lot lately. Hopefully I get some time to rest. Actually, I don't have anything on my schedule for the next couple of weeks, at least in terms of traveling. But if you're looking for a speaker, you're looking for someone to come out and speak, you know, a group of parents, a group of teachers, a group of minister, whoever it is in this realm, I am here for you. It's what I'm, and especially in this next year, I am dedicating my life to do it. Who knows, a year, don't wait till like 2 years from now. And I said the same thing about coaching. A couple years ago, I said, hey, like, this is the time. If you go back to my old podcast episodes, I was doing coaching for the low. I was, because I wanted to help a lot of people. I wanted to make a lot of it very accessible, but I knew it wasn't going to be forever. And I said, hey, it's not going to be forever. Take advantage of this now, right? I was doing coaching for as low as $20 a month. Look, check out my old podcast episodes. I'm telling you about it. But now I am doing this class, and this class is not going to be on forever, and this coach and the speaking that I'm doing is, I'm not going to be available to do it forever, because there will be other things that I'll be doing and prioritizing in my life. But right now, traveling and speaking is what I'm prioritizing. So this is the time to book me. Email me at chazlu@yahoo.com, and, or, you know, my email is also in the link in all my social media bios. Reach out. I'm here to help. I hope this has been helpful, and I'll be wishing you well.
What's my name?
Mr.
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 What's